Ryan Dixon and Rory Boylan host Tape to Tape, the hockey podcast by Sportsnet.
Mark, big news today in Brossard. You've just made one of the biggest trades in franchise history.
Well, it happened fast, obviously, when David Paul called me and he brought up the name of Shea Weber. He got my attention right away. I mean, PK, I don't take anything away from PK, but we're getting a world-class defenseman.
You know, it takes big ones to do that. There's no question. And Bergevin has big ones. I wouldn't ever doubt that.
You see, I'm extremely pleased for us to be able to announce that we've, as you know, we've signed Steven Stamkos to an 8-year contract extension.
He's comfortable down there. He's the captain. He knows the city, about the weather. There's no pressure like it would be on Toronto. He's a good team. They've been in the semifinals, finals. He's got a beautiful girlfriend. I mean, do you need any more reasons than to stay in Florida?
So today we traded Taylor Hall to New Jersey for defenseman Adam Larson. Significant trade for the Edmonton Oilers and for the New Jersey Devils.
Taylor Hall said it best. This is an indictment of him as a player. PK Subban should feel exactly the same way. These are two GMs who are 100% pointing the finger at them and saying, you're a problem in my room. I'm doing whatever I can to get you out. Boy, that's a stain on both of their careers. That's because of those GMs.
Welcome to Tape to Tape, T2T. I'm Ryan Dixon. I am a writer for Sportsnet Magazine and Sportsnet.ca. And sitting to my left, his head is still spinning from the craziest half hour in hockey history, Sportsnet senior producer for the NHL, Rory Boylan.
What a wild and crazy afternoon. We had that podcast that we did yesterday that lasted about 30 minutes before all this stuff went down.
Yeah, I was just getting home, ready to do a little work, flip up the computer, boom. In come the tweets, in come the texts. Yeah, we are going to dive right into it, folks. It really was a crazy, crazy short spell of time, kicked off by the Edmonton Oilers trading Taylor Hall to the New Jersey Devils for defenseman Adam Larson. You heard it, the guy with big ones. Montreal fans wanted the big deal. Maybe this isn't what they had in mind precisely. Marc Bergevin shipping out PK Subban to the Nashville Predators for Shea Weber, one for one straight up. And in the aftermath of that, while the world was burning, oh, by the way, Steven Stamkos is staying in Tampa Bay basically for the money that was being offered all along. We're going to dive into all that, but we will start with, I think, the biggest bone shaker of the day. It has to be a defenseman who has a Norris Trophy on his resume in the prime of his career, playing in what some people would tell you is still the place, the market, the city for hockey on planet Earth. PK Subban, gonzo for Weber. I won't even pretend we have any like format or anything. Like, we're just going to just go, Rory.
Yeah. It's a sad day, right? I can't believe that they made this trade. And from an on-ice perspective, you lose one of the most productive, certainly flashy players, excellent puck mover, excellent skater and all that great stuff. But off the ice, Subban did everything to immerse himself in the city of Montreal and in the Canadiens franchise.
Just wrapped himself in it.
Yeah. And now he's gone and he's not coming back again. And, you know, I remember exactly where I was. Now, I don't remember if it was the exact when the news broke or if I was just listening on the radio to reactions when Patrick Waugh was traded. We were going to a hockey game when I was a kid. And, you know, my family's all Bruins fans, so I'm not a Habs fan at all. But I remember that feeling, and just it felt wrong, and it felt like Canada had kind of lost something, you know, like something was off about that trade. And I have the same feeling about this one, too. It's the exact same feeling. It's this overwhelming sadness, and it's a shame that that they had to move a guy like Subban, and the fact he's not coming back. And Shea Weber is a really good player, and I think you'll look at a lot of the analytics and some of the articles that are going to pop up about this trade that are going to really kind of rip into the return Montreal got here and make it seem like a huge downgrade. And I think over the course of time, towards the end of their contracts, it will be. I don't think Weber is going to... I don't think his arrival is going to hurt the Habs that much in the immediate. I don't think it's going to... They're still going to be cup contenders as long as Price is around. He's still a very productive, powerful, great shot. He's going to be deadly on the power play for the Habs. So I don't think it's a... It's a such a massive downgrade. Like I've seen an analytics stat point out that
Shea Weber shouldn't be in the league.
Yeah, Shea Weber and Roman Josi were two of the five worst defensemen in the league, and that's where you got to draw the line and say something is wrong with this stat. You got to look a little bit deeper. So I don't think it's that bad, but just from an off-ice perspective and everything else around it, it's a real shame and it's a real sad day.
One interesting wrinkle to this, and I don't even know if it's possible to play devil's advocate, but I think we all understand the downside, so we might as well try and look on the flip the script a little bit. But agree or disagree, I think 0% of people on Twitter, 0% of people in the media would trade PK Subban for Shea Weber.
Mm-hmm.
I think that number is much higher if you pulled 30 NHL GMs. Do you agree?
I would agree for sure. There's still that old school element of grittiness.
Is that antiquated thinking then? Like, have the Canadians essentially opted for technology X when technology Y is about to rule the world?
Is it antiquated? To a degree it is, I think. If you're talking about trading a player like Subban and your rationale for it is you want to bulk up. And here's what I think. The Canadians way overcompensated for thinking they're too soft of a team. So in the sense that you have to trade a guy like Subban to correct...
Well, he's not soft either. I mean, he plays that edgy...
Exactly. Yeah, but what I'm saying is if you're trading that kind of a player and your rationale for it is to get bigger and stronger and everything, then yeah, you're way behind the times with that. You gotta realign here. But I do still think there's an element of that that you have to consider. That you need a physical toughness somewhere in your lineup to really... You want a well-rounded lineup still. And I think that there's still a place in the game for those kind of players. You need to have a skill set. The days of the pugilist,
right,
who can do nothing else are gone, but there's still room for the guys who are decent scorers. They can add a little to the score sheet every now and again, but basically their main attribute is that they're tough in the corners and they're hard to play against. I do think there's still room for that, but on this scale, boy, you better have more behind your thought process.
Well, and
that's
the thing, too. I mean, Mark Bergevin has to know if he's trading PK Subban, you know, I've been saying for the week that this seemed possible, and, you know, if I put on the hat of a Canadiens fan, when you first hear that PK Subban might be traded, unless you're a complete Subban alkalite and believe under no circumstances he can be traded, there's actually a little tinge in view that goes, ooh, what would they get for Subban?
Yeah.
And when you start hearing these packages of like, you know, the Edmonton situation makes you kind of think, ooh, you could really get some forwards there. Like, I don't know if the Canadians would absolutely positively have to get a defenseman back. I would think they would.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it kind of seemed like a thing where, well, maybe you could get a defenseman back who's 60% of what Subban is, and you develop Sergachev, and Beaulieu goes to the next level, and you can kind of see how the defense is okay, and you get a forward who you're rubbing your hands together going, how good's Draisaitl? How good's Jonathan Drouin? How good is Jesse Puljujarvi? Or one of those guys that provides a sense of possibility and hope that, well, this guy could really move the team forward. Does anyone think Shea Weber's going to move the Canadiens forward?
No.
At best, they tread water.
Yep. Yeah, at best, he's still a number one defenseman that Subban was. He has a different skill set. He brings different things to the table. But at the end of the day, they don't improve on this trade.
No, all the possibility rests with Nashville, right? That PK Subban can now go there and play through the prime years of his career and carry that team further than it had been able to go. Whereas
I don't think you can make that case with Montreal. But I will say, maybe to wrap the Subban Weber talk.
Well, I want to say just, you know, not only is Montreal not getting better right now, they're definitely getting worse down the line, right?
You're
trading away the best years of PK Subban, or most of the best years of PK Subban, for the declining years of Shea Weber. 100%.
Right.
There's no doubt about that. This is when players decline into their 30s. And, you know, I think, and this is just the general public Twitter and everything, the most defense I've seen of this trade is that, well, Shea Weber is on Team Canada and PK Subban is not, and it just, that's not how this works.
No.
I think the reason why PK Subban is not on Team Canada is because they're building a roster that needs
to
mesh there. Yeah, and it's not anything against PK Subban, it's just he's a freelancer and you don't really need that kind of a risk on that Team Canada. And it means nothing when you're comparing the two guys.
If you drafted the players on Team Canada one by one, the guys who would go ahead of PK Subban, the list might end at Duncan Keith.
Yeah. And before we wrap this up, I think we should look at this from the Nashville perspective. And I mean, that team is the real deal, man. You look at their defense
Go back to 2012 when they see a defenseman like Subban is in the prime years of his career, Ryan Suter, leave for nothing. They get nothing back. And in this amount of time, not only did they not really falter then, now in a very relatively short period of time, it's better than it was once upon a time.
Yep.
And through the course of that time period, they've also added the number one center, we think, that they've long been looking for. Pretty impressive.
They add, how many teams in the NHL, how many Canadian teams have been looking for that number one center or a number one defenseman forever?
All we hear
Nashville
is
Nashville did it in 1 year.
All we hear is you can't trade for those guys. Yeah, I mean, and I feel like Jim Neal's got the most praise for, well, look, you can trade for a number one center, maybe not number one D, but Poile definitely one-upped. Really impressive. And I would say the only way this ends up working for the Canadians is they have to win the Stanley Cup in the next 3 years when Shea Weber's still, like, what do they do now? Does this mean they're going after Eric Staal and Andrew Ladd, which you could say is throwing good money after bad money, but maybe the plan now is to go very hard on responsible deals for guys you think are going to make you better next year and the year after that, because other than that, the further you get from this trade, as you said, the more probable, not more probable, the further you get from this trade, the worse it's going to be for Montreal. Like in the next 2 or 3 years, okay, maybe.
Yep.
But beyond that, I don't think anyone sees it playing out well for the Canadians.
If this group doesn't win a cup with Shea Weber and Subban goes on to do what we would expect him to do and be one of the best defensemen in the NHL for the next however many years, if he wins another Norris Trophy, I don't think Nashville needs to win the cup. But if Nashville goes on a bunch of really deep playoff runs and Montreal doesn't win anything, I think everybody in that city is going to wonder, what if? What could we have done if we would have kept Subban? What could this team have been? Because It's just gonna slowly go downhill, and then you have to wonder too, with Carey Price 2 years left on his contract before he becomes a UFA, if they've declined enough.
Yeah,
I
sure.
I mean, if he leaves, it's done.
But I think Carey Price, just to wildly speculate, I mean the one thing, and it's too late in the game maybe to dive into this speculative world of the dressing room, but Shea Weber is a hockey player's hockey player. And I suspect the players on Montreal, and we know Price is buddies with them. I mean, they're, you know, Western boys.
Mm-hmm.
I think they view getting Shea Weber as like, you know, this is our boy. You know what I mean? Like, now, if on the ice, you're right. If they had two miserable seasons, Price may just be like, you know what, I'm out of here. But if things continue to be okay, we'll see. It's 2 years down the road, but my God, that would be the doomsday scenario. Some would say the doomsday scenario has already come to pass in Edmonton. The first jolt was the Oilers finally trading one of those very talented forwards. This one, drafted first overall 2010, Taylor Hall for Adam Larson. I will just start by saying, if you look at the Subban trade from the Canadiens' perspective, the Canadiens fans being the ones who are doing the, you know, face palms, as I said, it's like there's kind of no hope. The one thing Oilers fans can at least cling to is we haven't seen Adam Larson's best game in the NHL yet. Mm-hmm. So maybe we can reasonably conclude, based on what we've seen, that his best game isn't going to be good enough. But the bottom line is, there's just not any teams out there, with the possible exception of the Predators, I guess you could say, that could give up a defenseman that has commensurate impact or ability to Taylor Hall, a left winger, and not create a gaping hole on their own back end. So what the Oilers ultimately had to do was trade for a guy who they believe is going to become a number one. Because, yeah, I mean, like, you look at the Subban thing and you think, well, couldn't they just get together? But Montreal obviously believes it couldn't trade Subban for a forward and leave that size hole on its defense. And I assume it was pretty much the same for anyone else that would have been like, well, we'd love to add Taylor Hall, but we're just creating, we're trading one problem for another if we give you our best defenseman for him.
How much do you believe in Peter Chiarelli? That's, I think, what this comes down to, because remember, he was the GM in Boston when they traded Tyler Seguin away. And you look at that return and you look at it in hindsight now, and it's not really, I mean, Louis Erickson did not live up to what Louis Erickson was supposed to be.
He had a good
year this year.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then they're going to lose him to free agency, it looks like. And
that was, there was some extenuating circumstances there in that, let's not forget, well, Seguin looked like he was a serious problem child. And I understand, I understand in this day and age, we're supposed to value talent above all. But when you have Bergeron and Krejci as your 1-2, part of you goes, you know what? We can trade a young talent. Like, I don't know if Chiarelli knew he was going to be this good, but I don't think he thought he was trading a chump.
No, but, you know, you could, whenever he was a second overall draft pick and he had sky is the limit potential, other extenuating circumstances aside, he was a supremely talented player, and he traded him in the return, looking back, as, well, there's not really anything there for Boston anymore. And so now that he's traded the number one overall draft pick from that draft, Taylor Hall, away, you're, as an Edmonton Oilers fan, you have to, yep, there's two ways to look at it. You look at it as, okay, we didn't get back the huge return we thought we might get in a Taylor Hall trade, but we do get a defenseman who can log a ton of minutes. Supposedly he can play a, you know, a good shutdown, stable game that really is sorely needed in Edmonton. And that while this trade on its own, one for one, wasn't a, may not be a win, the overall process of building this team, there are sometimes concessions that you have to make to get to where you want to go. And if this is the first concession that the Oilers had to make, and this, and I think this is just the first in, I think there's going to be at least another move coming over this summer to address that defense. But if the end result is you're a team that's well-rounded and going to challenge for the playoffs, get into the playoffs, then fine, this deal is good. But on the other hand, you consider the Seguin trade, you look at this trade, you look at the return, you say, oh, no, not again. Don't tell me he's making the same mistake here that he made with Seguin. So he was, Chiarelli was brought in to fix this Oilers team and brought in with the idea that he was a terrific GM and the guy to fix this. So for Edmonton fans and onlookers, it's how much do you believe in the guy? How much do you trust him?
Yeah.
On the surface, it's, Edmonton's been looking for a defenseman for 2+ years, and this is the move they make. And I'm just like, how is this the best thing that came along?
Well, and how do you not at least be like, well, by the way, you're throwing in your first round pick from next year, or, you know, your next 2 seconds, right?
Yeah, and I think in Elliot Friedman's 30 Thoughts today, he said that Ray Shiro's stance was, I'm taking on salary, and that's it. And I'm not going to give up anything else. That's how valuable salary cap space is. But Yeah, my initial reaction to this trade was, this can't be a one-for-one. There has to be a mistake here, because Taylor Hall is one of the three or four best left-wingers in the game, bar none. Five-on-five, terrific production. And now he's gone, and you get a defenseman who, while he can log a lot of minutes, he's not a big point guy. He's not a terrific offensive generator, and you need to get that at some point, too, which it just tells me something else is going to come. And whenever all these moves are done and the dust settles, I hope we're looking at a better overall Edmonton team, or this trade just looks worse and worse and worse.
Yeah. I mean, you pretty much covered it all, but you're right. It's in some ways, it's difficult to tell an Oilers fan to have much faith in Peter Chiarelli at this point. I don't know. I guess I just keep going back to, you weren't going to get the defenseman equivalent of Taylor Hall. Like you said it, he's a top three guy in the league at his position. You weren't getting a top three guy in the league at defense for Hall, because no one can give up that guy without right. getting something back. Yep. So this was your play. Now, whether you think that guy might have been Jacob Trouba, or, you know, we have no idea if that deal was there, but you had to trade for a guy that it was going to involve some risk, and you're banking on some growth.
And you have to trust that Chiarelli obviously did his research and called around and searched out all the options, right? This wasn't
he didn't wake up and go, oh, let's try Larson.
Yeah, which, going back to Subban for a second, shocked me when Bergevin was asked about that, and he said that he got the call from Nashville, and that was the one and best offer, like serious best offer. Like, why? I mean, I struggle with so much trading a guy like that if you have one solid offer.
No doubt.
So with Chiarelli, you have to assume he absolutely searched high and searched low and didn't really want to have to trade Hull. And I think if he could, he probably would have rather have traded Eberle or Nugent Hopkins
Larson
for this defenseman.
Larson feels like an Eberle return, doesn't it?
Yeah,
like,
it really does.
That would have been like,
that would have been way more palatable.
Sure.
100%.
And if you're New Jersey, you probably still do that in a heartbeat, don't you? Or what do you think?
I wonder. I wonder if you play hardball with them and you kind of... It also makes me wonder how long these negotiations were going on for. But if you play hardball with them, like Steve Yzerman was playing hardball with the Steven Stamkos group, and you just let it play out and don't budge from your position, if New Jersey would have taken an Eberle instead of a Taylor Hall. Because, yeah, it strikes me as that is a more even deal than Taylor Hall, one of the best at his position, for Adam Larson, who, yeah, okay, we haven't seen everything from him yet, and he might be pretty good, and he's going to log a ton of minutes, but he's definitely not one of the best at his position.
Well, you mentioned the name. There's a couple real clear winners, a couple guys who come out smelling like a rose. Obviously, David Poile, Ray Shiro, you know, still just getting going in New Jersey, and a nice injection for his team. But my goodness, heavyweight champion of the hockey world, biggest onions in the game. Stevie, why? Woo! Wow.
He could not have played his hand any better, eh?
Like, this guy goes to Tampa, and all that happens is the world falls apart there. You know, the franchise face is PO'd because he's not on the best team on the planet, Team Canada 2014. Ends up still on the team and winning a gold, and still wants to be traded. Mm-hmm. Boom, doesn't blink. Trades him for, you know, got those picks, the first round picks, and because the Rangers went to the conference final, I feel like another one turned into a first round pick. Has, it seems like, you know, just after Tampa goes to the final and loses to Chicago, they lose 4-1 goal games. Man, they're really there, like knocking on the door. Your third overall pick, Jonathan Drouin, I think we could safely say gets a little, you know, nose out of joint because the other guys from his draft class are already playing. But Tampa insisted on bringing him along slow, the way Yzerman learned to do things in Detroit. Mm-hmm. I want to trade. How about you go to the minors and think about it? And we'll trade you if we get an enormous return.
Yeah.
Steven Stamkos, you think the deal is a slam dunk? It goes longer and longer. Gets to a point where I think everyone whether it was back in December or up to yesterday, is thinking, well, he's going somewhere else. I mean, yeah. If the deal was going to get done, yeah, don't forget when it leaked that I think the offer back in the winter was a flat eight per year. Some people are like, well, that's the death blow. That's the final insult. You just spat in his face. He's leaving for sure now.
Yep.
And all Steve Yzerman did was sit by his phone and go, he maybe didn't even sit by his phone. He's doing other stuff. And just wait for the call for them to say, you know what? Yeah, we'll stick around for that. Amazing.
Amazing.
Just didn't blink.
I never in a million years would have guessed that Steven Stamkos and Jonathan Drouin both would be on Tampa Bay's roster at the start of next season. But it sure looks like both are going to be. Steven Stamkos definitely will be. I can't imagine Drouin is going to get traded now that he's rescinded.
He can play with Stamkos. Why would he go anywhere?
Yeah. And now the biggest problem that they have is re-signing RFA Nikita Kucherov, which is going to get done. Amazing. I can't believe I was saying on the podcast that we recorded just yesterday, when it got this far, I mean, how did it get this far? How would it get this far and he re-signs in Tampa Bay? And it didn't make any sense to me that you would not sign the contract and then go and explore your options and you know, decide to go back to the team that you started off with for the price that they were offering you all along. But here comes Steve Yzerman. And, you know, I was of the opinion for a while that Yzerman was getting a lot of praise as a general manager, and he was being regarded as, you know, in the media and in the general public as one of the best GMs in the game, when I didn't think he'd really done enough to earn that yet. But my mind has completely changed. I think you saw two of the best GMs in action yesterday with Yzerman and David Poile doing some terrific things. Poile, of course, getting the first-line center and first-line defenseman this year, and Yzerman just keeping his team intact, which doesn't seem like the biggest accomplishment, but in this case, it certainly is. Look at this team. There is not another team in the Eastern Conference on paper that comes close to touching the Tampa Bay Lightning right now in terms of depth, skill, how well-rounded they are, position.
Who knows what happens if Strowman doesn't get hurt this year?
And they still have Ben Bishop, who is in every trade rumor that you can imagine out there, because they have Andre Vasilevsky ready to step in, and it looks like he can be just fine and steady in net for them. And what could they get for Ben Bishop? I would imagine they're going to trade him before the expansion draft next year. Goalie market isn't the greatest, but at this point, I'm expecting Yzerman to get a terrific return for Bishop whenever he does get moved. But man, what other Eastern Conference team, can you think of one that comes remotely close to the Tampa Bay Lightning right now?
No, I don't think so. I mean, that was the thing, is like when they went to the final, you're like, well, this team's great now, and there's every reason to believe they're just going to get better.
Yep.
And now there really is, because Stamkos is sticking around, and they do. I mean, yes, they have some cap issues to work out, but you're right, they have the flexibility. Like, they could go out there and trade even like a Tyler Johnson, because they have guys who can now slot into that number two center role, especially when you have Stamkos and Palat and Drouin on the wings. You have the ability to maneuver, and yeah, you can trade Ben Bishop to someone and say, by the way, you got to take this guy because we got to get rid of some salary. And that team, because they're getting Ben Bishop, will say, yeah, okay, we'll do that. So yes, I do not think there is a team that is better positioned to contend now and contend in perpetuity, really.
Yeah, and it, you know, Pittsburgh obviously was the team that came out of the East this year, and they could do it again at some point over the next couple of years. And they're obviously a terrific team loaded with star power, but I'm talking about overall top of the lineup, on down, the ages of the players, where you would project them to develop as a unit over the next 3, 4, 5 years. Tampa is still on the up, and Pittsburgh, well, they just won the Stanley Cup. They've peaked, and at some point, their stars are going to, I'm not saying next year, but at some point, it's going to start catching up to them, and they seem to have more, I think, cap issues than the Lightning do, when you have your best player, Steven Stamkos, making eight and a half. I mean, You got $8.5 million. We were talking about $10 million or more for Steven Stamkos.
I mean, how long after he's eligible to sign a deal do you think Victor Hedman goes, how about 8 years at 8.5?
Yeah, done. I wonder. Because you look at, so the two highest paid players in the league are Jonathan Toews and Patrick Kane, $10.5 million. And so that's $21 million one team is paying against the cap towards their two best players. And you look at Tampa Bay, and yeah, it's 8.5 for Stamkos, 5.8 for Callahan is probably over the top.
The one blemish maybe on Yzerman's
resume. Sure it is. And now, yeah, I wonder how many of these other players who are coming up, whether it's Hedman in a couple years or 1 year, or Kucherov right now, or anybody. Palette in a year, Tyler Johnson in a year, they look at this and say, okay, well, Stamkos stayed for 8.5. The tax implications, you don't have to pay as much tax as you do in a lot of the other cities in the NHL. I will take a little bit of a pay cut as well to stay and really take a few runs with this team. Chicago has managed it, as managed around the cap many times with the huge investments they made in their top players. And if Tampa can avoid that, then the bottom end of their lineup is going to be amazing as they just kind of keep it up around these guys. They're not going to have as many little delicate moves to make in the bottom of their lineup as Pittsburgh or Chicago have had to make. They're going to have a lot more room to kind of freestyle.
So let's put a bow on this by looking at it from the perspective of the team everyone thought might swoop in and continue its unstoppable march to a Stanley Cup. Is this a big blow to the Toronto Maple Leafs? Is this a shoulder shrug for the Toronto Maple Leafs?
I think it's a shoulder shrug. Not that it would have been amazing for them to get Steven Stamkos. And I'm not of the opinion that they dodged a bullet by putting too much money down on Stamkos, which is definitely a popular opinion out there. Because guys like Steven Stamkos never, ever become available.
And still don't.
And still don't. So if you had that chance to do it, you 100% take it and you run with it. But at the end of the day, it would have been a luxury ad for Toronto that you couldn't have ever imagined was a real possibility. So, you know, at the end of the day, the Leafs are still in a bit of a long rebuild and that would have been a nice luxury. They didn't get it. Oh, well, we'll move on. We still got a lot of nice young pieces that really fit better into what they are doing
Absolutely.
Right now.
Absolutely.
So while it would have been great, it's, you know, the sun comes up the next day and you move on and you keep going.
There are a few cities with people waking up going, the sun came up, it's okay, but I don't know. Feels like empty talk right now, I'm sure, in some cities, while others are just marching down the sidewalk and basking in the glow. It has been fun recapping, as I said, maybe the most wild and crazy half hour in the history of hockey transactions. That's it for our live update, but we're going to give you a little special bonus feature. We did lay down a pod yesterday on Wednesday, and the part that's going to stand up for some time is our chat with Sam Cosentino, Sportsnet.ca's prospects guru. So tacked on to this extra edition of T2T is that chat with Sam. So coming up after the break, enjoy Sam's take on some prospects and hang on for some more craziness hopefully ahead. We'll be back on Tape to Tape next week to wrap up free agency and set the league up in terms of 2016-17, who's looking good and who's trending down. That's it on T2T.
It's with great pleasure that we announce our 2016 first-round pick from the Memorial Cup champion London Knights, Matthew Tkachuk. People don't realize with Matthews how smart he is. I think he's got elite hockey sense. His ability to play with top players, as you said, is not an easy thing to do. He can think the game extremely well, goes to the hard areas to score, and then just does a lot of things to help you win.
What do you know about Toronto? What do you expect?
Well, I know everybody there is extremely passionate. You know, they obviously love the Leafs. It's a great sports town. You know, the Blue Jays, the Raptors, so they're obviously very passionate, and it's something you definitely don't want to take granted for. It's everybody's told me it's, you know, when they're winning, it's the best place in the league. So that's definitely something that I'm looking forward to.
Score for the career is the way we rank them. And our ranking was this, and Pierre-Luc Dubois was the guy that we wanted. It's as simple as that. It has nothing to do with position.
You know, I played right wing, left wing, but the fact that I could play center too, I think it showed a different asset of my game that nobody knew about. It was a new position, completely new, never played center in my entire life before. So, I mean, I learned fast, and I think in the long run I could play center in the NHL.
With the fifth selection, Vancouver select from the London Knights, Ole Ulevi. He had an outstanding year, whether it be at the World Junior, helping his team win the Memorial Cup. So it's a very exciting day for us. We're very happy to have him.
We'll say that you'll be true. We'll say that you'll be true. We'll say that you'll be true and never leave me blue. Susie Q. We'll say that you'll be mine. We'll say that you'll be mine. We'll say that you'll be mine, baby, all the time. Susie Q.
Welcome back to Tape to Tape. Joining us on the line now, it is Sportsnet's junior hockey all-purpose prospect guru, Sam Cosentino. Sam, how you doing?
Yeah, nice to be on. Still the draft fresh in everybody's mind, so yeah, excited to talk some more draft and prospects for sure.
Well, maybe fresh in the minds of some is the fact you kind of Babe Ruth the Dubois third overall selection. That was a rogue wave for a lot of people, but you had Pierre-Luc Dubois going third, just with one caveat that it probably wasn't going to be to the Blue Jackets. What was your take on that whole situation, and what made you think maybe Dubois would be, as he turned out to be, the third overall pick?
Well, I felt strongly that Columbus wanted to move the pick. I just didn't feel that Jarmo Kekäläinen had great praise for Jesse Puljujärvi. And in that case, I thought he was going to move the pick to acquire an asset because, in all likelihood, whoever would have traded for that pick probably would have taken him, except for maybe three or four teams. So I think that opened up the spot a little bit. The other element to that is, you know, I haven't seen Puljujärvi enough to really make the determination as to whether he was the third best player in that draft, but I've seen Pierre-Luc Dubois enough and have got to know him personally to know that you're not losing anything with his acquisition. So it wasn't a reach in my mind with him being the third best player available in this draft, and Columbus felt the same way and took him. And yeah, I mean, I did go out on a bit of a limb there, but I felt strongly about one of two things happening, either Dubois being, either that pick being traded or Dubois actually being the guy.
Sam, there were only three players in the first round who were taken who are under 6 feet tall, and it struck me because there were a bunch of other guys who are shorter than that who either were first-round prospects at some time during the year and may have even been on some of our mock drafts heading into the draft who fell to the second and even third round. And I'm thinking of guys like Will Bitton, Sam Girard, Alex DeBrincat, Rasmus Asplund. I'm just wondering how much is size still a factor for the NHL teams when they're deciding on these picks in the first round?
Well, I think they want to deal with size a little bit more prominently when it comes to your first round. So the percentages are already very difficult to get your first round player to become a regular National Hockey League player, around 68% to 72%, I believe. So probably a little bit underwhelming compared to what most people would consider. But as from what I've been told, those are the stats, that are prominent. And so I think size gives you a little bit better opportunity, improves your odds a little bit. You know, having said all that, you look at the top 10 scorers in the NHL this year, I want to say 6 out of the 10 of them are 6 feet or less. So there is obviously still room for that type of player in the game. But I think when drafting and looking at the skill set mixed with the size, there were just enough players for it to get through round one, and where maybe there were similarities between players with similar size. Or slightly differed in size, that I think the NHL is always going to rule towards slightly bigger, and that's probably the case of what we saw, which is all the bigger guys kind of going in the first round, like you mentioned, but also a rash of those smaller guys going very early in the second round.
Will Bitton, especially to me, shocked me how late he went, given that he was expected to go in the first round maybe most of the season, and he fell all the way to the third round to Montreal. I don't know if it would be him, but is there a player who you were surprised at how far he fell?
As far as falling goes, well, you know, Chychrun in the first round, but I wasn't overly surprised by that. I had him outside of my top 10. But when it comes to anyone else, right off the top of my mind, not necessarily. I will say this, though. I was rather surprised with Tyler Benson going, I believe, with the second pick in the first round, going to Edmonton. I thought he was a guy that was going to slip a little further down the list. I think Will Bitton's a wonderful example of a guy who probably should have been in that second round class of early movers, you know, up until the 45th pick. So I felt pretty strongly about that. But no one really outside of that shocked me. You know, I talked to a lot of people about Girard, a lot of people about DeBrinket. And yes, those guys were still early second round picks. But in terms of someone falling drastically, the only other guy maybe to me, and I think he went in the sixth or seventh, would be Tyler Soy out of Victoria. I watched a couple of his teammates, Jack Walker, go, Vladimir Bobolev, both of which went to Toronto as guys who were, I believe, second and maybe even third time through the draft for Walker. And those guys went ahead of where I thought Tyler Soy, who's a more skilled player in my eyes, went maybe in the sixth or seventh round. So that might have been one guy that shocked me a little bit with how far he dropped, even though he was in his second year of draft eligibility as a 97 born.
Speaking of the Leafs, why don't you give us your take on their haul after the first overall pick? I mean, everyone knew it was going to be Matthews, and I think, quite frankly, they probably could have left after that pick and been happy. But what about everyone else the Leafs drafted on a day when, even though they traded a couple away, they still had a lot of picks? Any guys that kind of jump out to you?
Well, Joseph Woll was a guy that I think Tyler Parsons was, you know, was in the crosshairs. But after they took Korshkov with 31, it wasn't going to be a case where Parsons was going to get to the end of the second or the beginning of the third round. But I really look at the draft, and I was fascinated by how many re-entries there were. Guys who weren't in their first-year eligibility. I talked about Bobolev, Walker. Korshkov's a fascinating guy who we've seen in our Canada-Russia series going back 2 years ago, who had played for Dave King and Yaroslavl, who was a highly, highly skilled guy, but a guy I thought they might have been able to find better value in down maybe with their third-round pick. But, you know, Mark Hunter identified a guy, saw it, and jumped up and took him in that particular spot. But I was really fascinated by the amount of older players that Toronto took, not necessarily first-year draft-eligible guys. And I don't know if that's part of the analytics, if people have been, you know, in the Maple Leafs analytics department have been running the analytics to say that guys that are in their second and third years of eligibility are more of a sure thing. They're a little bit older. They're a little bit more certain as what they're going to be physically and hockey-wise. But I'd be fascinated to try and get that question answered at some point.
We were talking about the Canadian teams in the first round and how well we thought they did and how neatly the players who fell to them were just perfect for where they picked them. How many of the players picked by Canadian teams in the first round do you think are going to come right up to the NHL next year?
Oh, that's a great question. I mean, I think all of them are going to give it a pretty good run. You know, Logan Stanley, maybe not necessarily, but I wouldn't be surprised if he got into a game or two. Olajuwon, same sort of thing. I wouldn't be surprised if he actually stuck longer than some people expected, but gets returned, you know, maybe in that November window somewhere. Let's see, we got Winnipeg out of the way. We got Vancouver with Olajuwon. We got Calgary, a really fascinating pick with Tkachuk. I think they were ecstatic to get him down where they got him at number six. So same sort of thing. I think he gets into games, but I think he goes back. I don't know if he's going to be able to right away keep pace with what the National Hockey League has to offer, yet he's really, really smart player. And then I look at the Edmonton Oilers, and Puljujarvi's a guy, I think, with his size, that's probably going to be able to step in right away and play some games. So, you know, Matthews and Puljujarvi, I'd say, would be the two guys that would probably be closest to being prepared to play in the National Hockey League a whole season. The other guys will probably get into some games, but most likely end up returning to their junior clubs.
Last one for you, Sam. I mean, is there any obvious draft winners? And if you want to toss in maybe someone, a team that disappointed you, feel free as well. But any one or two teams that you look at their haul and go, hey, this team kind of made out like bandits at the 2016 draft?
No question. I think Winnipeg would be at the top of the list because they were able to address two needs. They keyed in, obviously, on line A, who's going to be an excellent pick and a goal scorer at the next level. But I like what they did to move up to make sure that they were going to get Logan Stanley. I felt very strongly about Winnipeg's want to get Stanley, and to ensure that that happened, they moved up. So they addressed size, they addressed goal scoring, they addressed the defensive side of things. So I think they really did an excellent job. I also look at Calgary. Getting Tyler Parsons, I think, was huge for a team that's over the last couple of years has struggled in goal, but now they get a guy that, as a building block, that's probably not going to be ready to play for another 3 or 4 years, but at least kind of continue the foundation and allow Brian Elliott to go in there, get a couple of good years under his belt, allow Parsons to kind of hone his craft. I like what Chicago did in the second round. I think they had 3 picks in the second round. Kamov was one of them. DeBrincat was the other one, I believe, at number 36. I thought they did extremely well, considering they didn't have a first-round pick. They did make a move to acquire, I believe, 1 extra second-round pick. I like what they did. So those would be the teams that I consider came away, as winners. And, unfortunately, I thought this was a good draft. So when you're looking at teams like L.A., who only had 4 picks and didn't pick till late, pretty tough to make a determination on how things are going to pan out for a club like that down the road. But I thought this was a real good draft to have multiple picks, especially in the second round, where I think there's going to be a lot of value when we look at 3 and maybe 5 years down the road. I think you're going to find a lot of value in some of the guys that went in that second round.
Well, it's been almost a week since the draft, so I guess it's almost time to start making your 2017 notes, Sam.
Yeah, it's funny you say that. I got a note the other day from some people at work, and we're already moving in that direction, starting to talk about 2017. And, it was obviously a really important year this year for the Canadian teams based on where all of them were picking. Even Montreal at the 9th spot there is someone we didn't address, Sergachev, but I absolutely love him. And he's a guy who's probably going to do the same thing, stay for a little bit and then end up back in Windsor. But you have to think that this situation is not going to present itself again, where all the Canadian teams missed the playoffs, where a lot of Canadian people tuned out of hockey pretty early in the proceedings. I'd have to think that this is not going to happen again. So therefore, looking ahead to 2017, you have to think that maybe the importance for the Canadian teams, is, at least in my hope, isn't quite the same as it was for the 2016 draft.
Yes.
I think a lot of people hope that.
I think a few of us have our fingers crossed there. All right, Sam, we'll let you get back to it. Thanks for joining us today.
Okay, thanks, guys. Take care.
That is Sportsnet.ca's Sam Cosentino wrapping up the 2016 draft. And we're going to wrap up T2T. And we're going to put a bow on T2T for this week. But come back next time for more glass rattling hockey action. On Tape to Tape. She's up against them all, but the writing's on the wall. There's more than meets the eye with her. Nothing I can do. I'm left without a clue. She sees it all in black and white or blue. She's got a rainbow high. One day she's gonna fly. She's got a rainbow high. She's up against them all.
This has been Tape to Tape, the hockey podcast by Sportsnet.